Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a regular series of coronavirus conversations, presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We've been taking your questions to the experts. The whole discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. This week, I spoke with Dr. Andy Chan about tracking what's often called long COVID, or the long-term symptoms that many with COVID-19 experience. Chan is a gastroenterologist at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's also a professor of medicine at Harvard's Medical School and professor in the Department of Immunology and Infectious Diseases at the Harvard Chan School. Andy, as we've learned about COVID-19, more and more, it's becoming clear that a majority of people who get sick do feel better within a couple of weeks. But at the same time, a significant number of people continue to have symptoms long term that can linger for months. I've seen estimates of 1 in 10 people, 1 in 20. And this can include symptoms, things like fatigue, headache, brain fog, heart trouble, sleep problems, lots of different things. And it's causing lots of suffering in individuals. This is something that you've been looking into, actually. More than a year ago, you started an effort using a smartphone app to track COVID symptoms and spread. And normally I wouldn't be jumping on like an app, but you actually, like, 4 million people have signed on to this thing. From what I understand, it's mainly in the UK, but also the US and a few other countries. So I wanted to just kick things off to ask you about that research and what have you learned from that data about long COVID?
Sure, Alana. So, you know, I think the COVID symptom study is an app-based study that we started back in March of 2020. We realized very early on that one of the biggest challenges of the pandemic was really being able to collect high-quality data that represented a broad segment of the population that could really give us some information about a disease that no one had ever seen before. And, you know, I think we, you know, think usually about epidemiology studies as having the benefit of time to really plan a study and to really be able to calibrate survey questions and really figure out how to get the instrument out there and collect data. But in the face of really this rapid sweeping pandemic, we needed to stand up a tool that was able to reach a lot of people very quickly to give us information very quickly. And this would give us the ability to provide, you know, critical rapid data back to scientists and also return it back to the public at large so people could really understand more about the disease. You know, I think that the study really came from the idea that this is a citizen science effort, that we need everyday people around the world to really share information about COVID and to help us to really be the boots on the ground, if you will, to really help us to learn about the disease and do that in real time, especially as things, you know, unfolded so quickly across the world. So we launched the study back in 2020 with partners in the UK, based on work we'd done previously on a digital health app for a nutritional study. And I think it's sort of an example of a situation where, you know, like many physicians, you know, you can think about ophthalmologists wanting to you know, go to the front line and help. Epidemiologists, you know, in this case, like myself, a chronic disease epidemiologist or a cancer epidemiologist really wanted to help. And so we pivoted to become, you know, COVID epidemiologists, whether we wanted to or not, because we really felt the need to get out there. So with our partners in the UK and also a health sciences company, Zoe, we launched this app in three countries, the UK, the US, and Sweden, and very quickly managed to get 4.5 million people to provide us information. And it's really been a tremendous resource, I think, for helping us understand more about COVID, you know, both risk factors for why people get sick, but also understanding more about symptoms of COVID. For example, in the app, we identified pretty early on that loss of smell was an important risk factor to look out for. And we've then continued to collect data. And as the pandemic has changed, and as we sort of come up with new questions, and as sort of these new issues like long COVID have really become predominant, it's given us additional information and data to really be able to address that in a very concrete way. And now that we're in a new phase with vaccinations, we're learning more and more about vaccines. So it's really been a wonderful opportunity to really, I think, make some contribution to what we know about COVID.
There's like 20 questions packed into everything that you just said. To start, what are you learning about symptoms? What are people experiencing months out from COVID?
So to give you a sense of what the app actually is asking people to do. So we ask people to join the app, and the first time they join, they provide just some baseline health information, like what is, you know, sort of your baseline health, some demographic information. And that's been the source of information about that we've been using to try to understand what are risk factors, why people get sick. But then we also ask people, you know, what symptoms are you experiencing? And I think what's been important is that we're asking people across the population, whether they have COVID or not, what symptoms they're experiencing. And we want to be able to prospectively, I mean, in advance, capture the symptoms people are experiencing before they get diagnosed. And this gives us a sense of what symptoms are really sort of coming up in the general population and what are the ones that really do end up potentially leading to a diagnosis of COVID. And that's positioned us to kind of look at this over the long term, because we ask app users to log in again on a daily basis and ask us how they feel. And if they feel fine and they don't have any symptoms, it's very quick. They just press a button saying, "I feel fine." But if they actually are experiencing anything new, they report that. So it allows us to capture again in real time on a daily basis, prospectively, what those symptoms are that they're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And this has allowed us to create sort of a cohort of individuals on the app which have experienced symptoms and then been diagnosed with COVID, and then follow them after their diagnosis to see what symptoms they're continuing to experience. And this is where we've been able to really identify a group of people that are continuing to experience symptoms beyond where we kind of expected people to experience symptoms. And, you know, we've been able to identify people that continue to have symptoms 2 weeks out, 4 weeks out, 6 weeks out. So we can really sort of get at the prevalence of long-term symptoms and also the type of symptoms people are experiencing. And then also look back at what symptoms they experienced before they got sick to see, could we maybe have predicted that this person was going to develop long COVID? So it's been the ability to kind of be a tool that continues to be used and continues to ask people to continue to contribute that allows us to longitudinally follow people and track people, which I think has been really valuable.
Based on what you've just said, are you able to predict who might be most at risk to develop long COVID symptoms and who might recover more quickly?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the very first questions we asked is like, how common is it for people to have long-term symptoms? I think that was even early on not really clear because a lot of the earliest studies on long COVID were kind of focused on the recovery for people that were in the hospital and were really sick. And those studies really were coming out with very, stark numbers. You know, we were looking at some studies out of Europe and which suggested that maybe, you know, the majority or 80% of people were still, you know, suffering from symptoms after their infection. But again, these were people that were sort of the sickest of the sick in the hospital. So it really wasn't clear what was going to be the disease course for the vast majority of people that don't get hospitalized and have relatively mild symptoms. So we were able to use the app to identify that group of people, the people that had relatively mild symptoms that were not hospitalized, and found that about 15% of people were still reporting continued symptoms after 28 days, which was kind of, you know, similar to what other studies were turning out. And I think that's what other studies have kind of shown as well. And you can sort of look at different studies, but it looks like the prevalence is somewhere between, you know, 15 to 30% of people with with mild symptoms may have longer term symptoms. And then because we also collected the information about what symptoms they experienced before they got the infected, we asked the question, what could predict who was going to get long COVID? And we did find that people who presented with multiple symptoms, i.e. they had not just, you know, a cough or a fever, but, you know, cough, fever, and, for example, loss of smell. If you had multiple symptoms, that puts you at about a threefold higher likelihood of getting long COVID. And we also found that people who were older were more likely to get long COVID, and people also, women were more likely to get long COVID. So it looked as if there were some sort of baseline risk factors, i.e. Age, that was important to consider, but also potentially the symptom course could predict whether someone's going to end up with longer term symptoms.
Hmm. The severity, does that play into it?
It's a tricky one. So on our study, we didn't see any strong correlation between severity of symptoms. You know, we didn't capture maybe the full spectrum of severe symptoms because, you know, we were a sort of an app community-based study. So I think we tended to select for people that were not as sick as the people that ended up getting hospitalized. So if you sort of take our study and sort of complement that with some of the other studies that have come out of those hospital-based patient populations, it does broadly seem like people who were more severely affected do have a higher risk of developing longer-term symptoms, but it's definitely not essential. I think even people with relatively mild symptoms can end up with long COVID. And that's been borne out by other studies too. And there's even some suggestion that people may be asymptomatic to start with and then develop, you know, symptoms well after they've recovered from the virus. So I think it is going to be kind of a very broad spectrum of disease course for people. So I don't think severity of symptoms is necessarily the best predictor of whether someone's going to have a longer term course.
What do we know about what drives this in terms of the long-term symptoms? And I want to package this with another question, which is this a uniquely COVID thing as well?
It's a great question. And I think one that has really been the sort of holy grail of COVID research is sort of what is the mechanism for why COVID can lead to long-term symptoms? And what is it about COVID that makes it so different than other typical respiratory viruses or communicable viruses? I think the major comparison people make is with influenza. And I think when COVID first struck back in early 2020, I think people kind of presumed it was going to be kind of a severe case of influenza and that, like most people with the flu, they will recover. And when they recover, they should, you know, long-term have no you know, after effects. But that's really how COVID has been different. You know, it is clear that COVID is not like the flu, that people do, you know, often have lingering symptoms. So it does raise the question, how is it different from a mechanistic standpoint? Biologically, what is COVID doing that's different to our bodies that other viruses like influenza does? I think it's very much an open question. There's been a lot of speculation. And I would say probably one of the leading thoughts or hypotheses is that people who react to the virus immunologically in sort of a more robust way. So if their immune system kind of goes into overdrive as a response to the virus, that could have some long-term effects on different organ systems that we see with COVID, mm-hmm. Long COVID. There's also some thought that there might be some specific subtypes of long COVID, that there might be, for example, neurologic sequelae or neurologic complications of long COVID that could have a different mechanism from, for example, the shortness of breath or, you know, the gastrointestinal symptoms some people experience. So I think just in the way that long COVID is so incredibly diverse in the way it presents, I think there's going to be a diversity of potential explanations and biological mechanisms for what's going on.
The NIH announced big funding for more than $1 billion for studying long COVID. And I wonder how you anticipate that research, the focus of that research, and some of the big questions you hope that might address. I've also seen in reporting, you know, a movement amongst individuals, for example, in communities around chronic fatigue syndrome and ME, see this as an opportunity to expand knowledge and understanding of other illnesses that often have lots of questions still unanswered that require more digging into, that for many, many, many years and decades maybe have not been as much of a focus.
Right. No, I think it's exciting that the NIH has really been, you know, trying to address these questions with research. So I think that the NIH initiative, which is this post-acute sequelae of COVID research initiative, is designed to galvanize the research community to get at answering these questions in a way that is rigorous and in a way that's broad and really considers all the possibilities. You know, all these data that we've been discussing about long COVID have come from, you know, efforts that are you know, incredibly important, but have been limited in scale. Mm-hmm. And they've been limited both in terms of, you know, how they were able to collect the data, the populations they studied, the approaches they took. So it has been kind of patchy. And that's why our knowledge about long COVID still is really in its infancy. I think what is needed is some broad-based, large-scale effort to really address this question that brings together a large number of researchers and also recruits a large number of individuals into their studies. So we really need people to participate in the studies and also provides the appropriate resources to really address these questions, both in terms of understanding the disease, but also trying to get the biology behind it. So I think this is an open and exciting opportunity for the future when I think this initiative really kicks off. But I think to your point, I think what this has highlighted is that a lot of these symptoms that we think about with long COVID overlap with other chronic illnesses. And those are all chronic illnesses that have been around for a while and are also unfortunately understudied and for which there isn't, you know, potentially enough resources being spent to move the needle on progress in those areas. So to the extent that some of the understanding of long COVID might have an impact on chronic diseases that may share similar biology and mechanisms, I think it'll be hopefully, you know, the dawn of new developments in that area. And chronic fatigue syndrome is a great example that you provided, but there are numerous other examples. I think, you know, fibromyalgia, mm-hmm. as a rheumatological condition, these sort of as a gastroenterologist, we see people with functional bowel disease or irritable bowel. So a lot of these symptoms kind of overlap with what people are experiencing with long COVID. So, you know, I think we might get some clues into how those diseases might affect people and how we can better handle them.
This question comes from Ari, but I wanted to just preface it with, I'm really struck by the ways in which patient communities have really rallied also for doing kind of patient-led research to crowdsource what are experiences with symptoms. Body politic was one of the ones that comes to mind. And one of the big conclusions early on had to do with the need for more care and treatment and support to understand that this is complicated with patients who do experience these things and to have the resources there to support that within the health community, but also the broader societal supports. Ari is asking, are there studies underway regarding treatments for long COVID symptoms? And what are we learning about treatments?
So to your point, yeah, I think that the patient advocacy that has been really fueling attention to long COVID has been so important. And I think that patient advocacy is in large part what has really galvanize the research community. And I think that's what's motivated, for example, the NIH initiative. So by, and I think it's also been such an important source of information. I think getting some of the initial understanding of long COVID, the symptoms that people are experiencing, just characterizing long COVID as a condition, couldn't have been done if it weren't for these patient advocacy groups like Body Politic and, you know, other groups that have come on Facebook. And I think it does provides an example kind of our approach, in that there is a need for citizen science. There is a need for people to participate in research, survey data, share what they're feeling so that we can understand and learn more, and we can prioritize it as a scientific community. As to the question of treatment, I think that this is something that is going to hopefully emerge from this NIH initiative. I think there is, you know, more and more across the country, examples of programs that have been stood up relatively quickly in hospitals to really meet the needs of patients who are experiencing long COVID. And that has, I think, created, you know, again, opportunities to learn more about it, but also create opportunities to further the understanding of how to better take care of these individuals and take care of patients with long COVID. And one thing that's become clear from these early initiatives is that it's going to require, I think, multidisciplinary care, that because long COVID impacts so many different organ systems, it's not going to be in just the purview of the infectious disease doctor. It's not going to be, you know, just the lung doctors who take care of these patients. It's going to require probably people with different specializations and different backgrounds of expertise, but also not just require, you know, medical care and medical treatment. I mean, you also will need to really think about mental health consequences of long COVID. So making sure there's mental health support for these clinics and as a way to kind of get people through some of these symptoms, but also potentially other sources of novel interventions. I think, you know, there's certainly different places around the country that are thinking through the impact and measuring the impact of, for example, providing additional social support, providing even nutritional or dietary support. So I think there's a lot of multidimensional care that's happening with respect to this disease, which I think will teach us a lot about also how we manage other chronic diseases that maybe have similar, you know, multi-organ system, multiple symptom manifestations.
How important is mental health in this, in terms of thinking about both the care, but also the impact of COVID? I know that your research has been trying to address this, as has others. What can you tell us about that?
Right. So I think alongside, you know, the attention that's been paid to long COVID, I think is also emerging appreciation for the impact of COVID-19 on mental health, and that there are potentially mental health consequences of COVID-19. Which may or may not fall within that sort of, you know, category of illness we call long COVID, but could be kind of a distinct kind of group of long-term outcomes that we have to really be aware of and capable of responding to. And I say this because I think there are clear data that COVID-19, getting infected with COVID-19 might have long-term mental health consequences for people, but also even for people that have not been infected by COVID-19, I think the last year of the pandemic has really had a mental health impact like no other. It's been such a disruption to people's lives and routines, their ways of interacting with people, that even if people have not gotten sick with the virus, they've become ill, or worsened in terms of their mental health from, you know, the impact of the disruption to their lives. So we're really interested in trying to collect more data on this across a broad population. So in the COVID symptoms study app, we did launch a mental health questionnaire last month, which I think is hoping to be able to address some of these questions. You know, what is the impact of the pandemic and lockdown on mental health? Mm-hmm. What is the impact of having the infection on mental health? And also, you know, some also questions about, you know, what is someone's sort of baseline history of mental health conditions? How did that potentially put them at risk for either getting infected or having long-term sequelae of COVID-19? So is there potentially a link between having pre-existing issues with mental health that could, you know, manifest themselves as longer-term symptoms?
This is just a really specific question about the app, since we're talking about that, that a lot of questions have come in that of people who are using it about how people report on the app that they are participating in vaccine trials and how best app users can provide feedback or ask questions about the app and what's being asked or additional info.
Yeah, great. It's wonderful to have people joining us who have been using the app. Again, we're so grateful for the participants on the app because it's really their efforts and really their you know, willingness to participate that's been so vital in this research and being able to promote the science. And I just really want to continue to thank the participants because it's really been such an important initiative. And it's caught the attention of for example, Dr. Collins at the NIH. I mean, I think he specifically cited work on our on long COVID as being one of the things that I think has motivated this interest in this research. So I do want to thank the people that are listening that are using the app. We are, really trying as best we can to kind of adapt to the changes that have been so rapid in COVID. So for example, we did, very quickly try to add questions about vaccinations as people were getting vaccinated, but also had to be aware of the fact that there are people, many people across the country that have also volunteered for clinical trials. And so we've needed to also think about how to accommodate trial participation on the app, which has been a bit of a challenge. So we've been trying to pivot as quickly as possible to kind of rapidly adapt our data collection tool to meet what people are experiencing. And we're very open to feedback. So people can definitely send feedback through the app, but we also have here in the US, a specific set of volunteers that really sort of staff the app and help respond to user questions. And so they can reach us, at predict@mgh.harvard.edu. That's just the email address. It's predict@mgh.harvard.edu. And we try to, address them as quickly as we can.
There's a lot of questions that have come in actually about vaccines. I want to kind of list a few of them because they're a bit interconnected, but basically, from Liz, I've heard some people with long COVID start feeling better after getting vaccinated. Is that true? Any guesses about why and why others don't get relief? This is an email from Smadar. Is it possible that increased long COVID symptoms are connected to being vaccinated? So a flip question.
Right. So I think I alluded to this a little earlier. I think the jury is still out as to what, if any, impact vaccination has on long COVID. As you would imagine, it's an area that people are intensely interested in because just the sheer number of people that have long COVID, but also just because, we're trying to get everybody vaccinated. So we really need to understand this because we want to obviously make the best recommendation we can going forward. I think there are small surveys that have been done, some of them in different countries, some in the US, but relatively small surveys of people who were sort of in the initial wave of vaccinations that did report that there was a considerable proportion of people, maybe up to a third of people, who were experiencing long COVID symptoms that felt they got better after a vaccine. And there was also a few, studies that showed that there was a not insignificant number of people that felt like they got worse. So it is kind of not clear, but I would say that it's more likely than not that it either has no effect or maybe improve symptoms. I think the data, that potentially worsens symptoms is not as strong, and it's probably not as common an outcome. So I think we're still very much as a medical community trying to really promote people getting vaccinated, whether or not they've had COVID in the past, because I think the likelihood that it's going to worsen COVID or long COVID symptoms is probably very, very small. Hmm. Now, if it does improve symptoms, why would that be? I think there is some thought that maybe if you rev up, someone's ability to fight off, some of the factors that have led to long COVID symptoms with the shots, that could be a part of what we're seeing. It could be also that some of the effects of vaccination have to do with, mounting immune response against certain components of the viral infection that maybe, have been also underlying the physiology for why long COVID has developed in some of these people. So it might be that the immune response that people mount to the virus might cross talk with, maybe a response that could be useful to fighting off some of the mechanisms that cause long COVID symptoms. But because we don't really know the mechanisms underlying long COVID, it's really hard to be sure.
This is just a quick follow from Lori, which you sort of answered, but the question is why introduce a vaccine? Like, could it cause further stress on the body if you have long COVID? Could that generate an additional immune response? And so just more curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that was certainly one of the open questions. I think that was an initial concern and why I think we really needed and wanted to track people who had long COVID and their response to vaccinations to see if that might be the case, because we certainly didn't want to be in a situation where we were actually worsening long COVID for some people. And I would say that based on the studies that have been done so far and based on the early data that have emerged from vaccination programs, I think that's not likely to be the case. I think it's extremely rare that that has been reported. So I think that current recommendations to get vaccinated, even if you've been infected with COVID, I think are still quite important, and I think still should be widely promoted. But it is an area that we need to continue to study. And that's one of the things that we're doing in the COVID symptom study app is, tracking how people with long COVID are doing post-vaccination. So hopefully we'll be able to have some data on that in the near future. But that also will be data, hopefully, that will come out of other places and also maybe will be a result of the NIH initiative. So I think more information to come, but I think the early signs is that it does not likely worsen long COVID, and people who've had COVID should still get vaccinated.
This question is from Jin. Are some COVID variants likelier to cause long COVID?
Great question. I think that's also been an area of intense interest. I think at this point, we don't believe so. I think our early data from, for example, the B.1.1.7 variant, or what people have been colloquially calling the UK variant, doesn't appear like illnesses have been more likely to result in long COVID. We've also been interested, are the variants also potentially causing a different set of symptoms to begin with? For example, is it possible that some of these variants may be more likely to result in, gastrointestinal symptoms and less likely to result in respiratory symptoms? I think there are some suggestions that that might be the case, but again, I think the studies are relatively small. So we do, I think, require bigger studies. And so that's also something we're looking at in the COVID symptom study.
Are you seeing, we've seen with COVID-19 expose a lot of disparities and inequities, both in who is more likely to get sick and infected, hospitalized? Are you seeing disparities, racial disparities in long COVID as well?
Yeah, that is a great question and one that is really a scientific priority. I think we are needing to address this simply because it's pretty clear that the impact of COVID-19 has been disproportionate on communities of color. And I think it would not be surprising to imagine that the impact is also disproportionate with respect to long COVID. So, but we don't, I think, have enough information to know for sure. Certainly on an absolute scale, meaning on terms of just the number of people who have long COVID, I think the proportion will be disproportionately true that disproportionately represented by people of color simply because they're more likely to have been infected in the first place. But does their actual individual risk of developing long COVID differ because of their racial ethnic background? I just don't think people know that. And it is also complicated by the fact that, there's a lot of other social determinants of health that also are at play here. And that also could affect the trajectory of what someone's experiencing with respect to COVID. So we know, for example, that, there are probably, other risk factors for COVID, occupational risk factors or community level risk factors, which could contribute to risk of long COVID. And those are very tightly linked to race ethnicity. So I think those are all things that have to be looked at in much more detail.
This question's from Catherine. Given that your research started, over a year ago, obviously this virus has not been around for much longer than that. But are you seeing, how many people are you seeing report enhanced symptoms like months 11 through 13, long-term in that way?
We are just starting to get some early data on that. I think it does look like, when you start to think about 3 months out, 6 months out, that the prevalence of long COVID does decline. So I think that is a bright spot in that maybe, it does require just more time for people to recover. Hmm. But depending on the study and depending on how you define long-term symptoms, I think the estimates have been that, at 3 months, for example, we're looking at probably, 10% of people will have something lingering at 3 months. And then as you sort of stretch out that time frame longer, it does look like the percentage continues to drop. Because we do have obviously the benefit of having people on the app for a little bit over a year, that's the kind of thing we're seeing in our data, that it probably starts to, peak around, long COVID probably peaks around a month or so with about 15% of people. And then it's sort of trended down as we followed out that cohort longer. By 3 months, it's probably around 10%. By 6 months, more like 5%. So I think we are seeing that there has been some decline over time in longer-term symptoms, which I think is hopefully a positive and hopefully will hold up. But that still leaves a significant proportion of people that will have persistent symptoms long-term. And they may also have a different set of symptoms, and they may have different severity of long COVID symptoms that are important to consider as well.
I wonder, you're also a practicing doctor and see patients, some who have COVID, some who don't. There's often, I've interviewed people who have talked about having long COVID and faced challenges of being taken seriously with symptoms. And I wonder how your research affects or kind of informs how you advise patients and doctors and health workers and nurses about knowing and seeing that this is a significant number of people do experience symptoms and there's still a lot to learn. How does that inform how you advise patients and the medical community to advocate for each other and how to best respond to it?
No, I mean, I think that in the initial phase of reports of these long-term symptoms, I think there was skepticism. And I think even among my colleagues, I think there was skepticism that this was a real thing. There was, suggestions that maybe this was just, kind of a non-specific kind of, condition that was not really physiologic, that maybe it had more to do with the sort of the was a completely psychological issue, that there wasn't a physical issue. But I think that people have gradually come around, and I think that's in large part due to, as I mentioned, some of these groups like Body Politic and some of these patient advocacy groups have really put it at the forefront of people's attention. And I think that's also led to the medical establishment at large paying more attention. And that I think has to do with some of that advocacy. So for example, the NIH initiative is a good case in point, but also just the focus that researchers have had on long COVID, I think provide some optimism that people are taking this seriously and hopefully will allow more and more of my colleagues to be educated to look out for it, to know how to address it in a way that's both sensitive and effective. And also, I think, lower the barriers for patients to seek medical attention for some of these symptoms. Because that is also a factor, is that, some people maybe have such sort of subtle symptoms that they maybe are dismissing them, or they don't feel like they can do anything about it, so they don't seek medical attention. But I think we're hoping that people will not feel that way in the future. Mm.
What would be symptoms that maybe might be internalized as like, oh, why bother with this? Or is this something?
Yeah, a really good case in point is a colleague I have who is a healthcare worker. And she, got sick very early on in the pandemic, came back to work, and just, was able to do her job, but just didn't feel right, and kind of was more fatigued at the end of the day, just didn't feel the same sort of zest she had for going through her job, and just felt the sense of chronic fatigue. And I think early on maybe was kind of not so worried about it, kind of thought maybe it was just the fact that she was tired from working so many hours, that she was, also stressed from, having to care for so many sick patients. And so I think she kind of attributed it to other factors and never really thought twice that maybe it was something that she was experiencing as a long-term complication of the COVID. Mm. But as she heard more and more about people like her feeling this way, I think it made her more aware of the possibility that she was experiencing kind of a longer term symptom of the virus. And that's been a story that I've heard in other scenarios as well. And I think it is certainly something that is going to be increasing in incidence as we sort of get, hear more of those stories as people are starting to, try to get back on their feet and go back to work and go back about their regular lives, they will probably notice some subtle differences, and maybe those are related to COVID, and that they should be able to feel comfortable bringing them up to their healthcare providers.
Do you find that that informs the way you might ask questions to patients, or maybe in the way that patients think about how they talk about their experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I think more and more I'm feeling like when I'm seeing a patient in clinic who's had COVID infection, I will be very open-ended and ask how they're doing, and leave that to them to tell me what symptoms they're experiencing. And I think that's been helpful because, long COVID can be subtle. It can affect multiple body sites, multiple organ systems, or can be multiple symptoms. So it isn't so easy, and I don't think really appropriate for us to jump in right away with the laundry list of symptoms and try to interrogate people about those symptoms. I think we're still at a stage where I think we should be relatively open-ended to kind of hear what people are experiencing. And I think we'll be surprised by some of their stories and be surprised that, some of the things that they're experiencing are things that maybe we hadn't necessarily thought of as being linked to the virus. So I think being open-ended has taught me a lot about, potential symptoms to look out for. And I think has hopefully informed a little more about the approach I take in terms of helping people through it.
Thank you for taking all these questions. We've run over a bit because there are so many. I wanted to wrap up just by, it seems like there's a lot still to learn, but I wonder, just given in this year, a lot that you have learned about long COVID, to wrap up, I mean, what are some of the main takeaways you have about what you know now about long COVID as you look into the future? And also, what are the main things that you hope to learn more about?
I think the takeaway is that I think long COVID affects a substantial number of individuals who've had the virus. It can take many forms, those forms can be subtle, but they can also be quite severe. And it can impact people in ways that are really problematic for the long term. And I think specifically about the fact that, you know, a lot of the attention early on in COVID was justifiably about, you know, people who are older, who are getting sick and unfortunately dying of the virus. And people were not quite as concerned or focused about the fact that there was a large number of young people getting infected, because I think there was, you know, good evidence that young people could recover and probably weren't going to end up getting hospitalized. But as we can see at the this later phase of the pandemic, that the vast majority of people that are getting infected are younger, I think we're at a at a tipping point where I think we're really going to potentially see even higher reports of long COVID and more people reporting in absolute numbers long-term symptoms, and the impact of that on our workforce and on our society, I think, will be felt for many years to come. So I think that's something that I think I've been more and more appreciative of based on the research and based on just my experience in the clinic. And long-term, I think that's where we need to focus our energy, is like, how do we get people back to health? You know, how do we get people back to the ability to live and work the way they did before the pandemic and to be able to, right the ship when it comes to, making sure that we get back on our feet as a country. And I think that's really what my hope is for the future. And that's what I hope comes out of some of the exciting research that's happening. And ultimately, I think this will have hopefully implications for how we think about caring for patients with other diseases that might have overlap with long COVID. So I think that this does represent also a possibility of a new sort of renaissance, I think, in our understanding of some of these conditions that were relatively under resourced and kind of dismissed by the medical community.
That was Andrew Chan, a gastroenterologist at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's also a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a professor in the Department of Immunology and Infectious Diseases at the Harvard Chan School. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this conversation on our Facebook pages at Forum, HSPH, and at PRI The World, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.